Hello everyone, and welcome to my very first podcast just for the inner circle, the members. Shedcast 1, the practice of diplomacy in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. How exciting is that? So there was I, sitting around in far, far away, eating bonbons and cavorting with every little last fairy tale creature that has ever done you wrong, when a thought struck me. There's this bloke, right, called Eustace Chapuis. Those of you who are Wolf Hall fans or just Tudor Henry VIII fans will probably know him. Eustace was the ambassador to the court of Henry VIII of England. We know an awful lot about the ins and outs of Henry's court from Eustace's reports back home to his master, Charles V, Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and, as it happens, the nephew of Catherine of Aragon, Queen of England. He was a writer, both terrific and prolific was Eustace, and a keen and acute observer of people. And, of course, a horrified participant in the dance that led to the brutal putting aside of Catherine of Aragon by her husband. Anyway, then it struck me that we suddenly seem to have this rich source of information where previously we had not, because in a way it's quite gossipy. Who's in, who's out, who's up, who's down, all that sort of thing. There's a lot of the same stuff from a man called Pedro de Ayala, the ambassador to the court of Henry VII, from the Catholic monarchs of Spain, and again it gives us another kind of insight that up to now has been very rare. For example, commenting that Henry VII is under his mother's thumb and his wife doesn't like it. This is the kind of reporting that these ambassadors were regularly sending back to their masters. Now I'm writing this around episode 197, about 1485 in terms of the podcast, so it then occurred to me to wonder where all these ambassadors had been previously. And then dump! Of course I realise that the diplomatic system we take so much for granted now simply didn't exist up to this point. Which leads to this episode. What had gone on before? How did nations and kingdoms talk to each other and create all those treaties and agreements? What led to the appearance of these trendy new ambassador things? And one thing led to another, as things so often do, and so here we are in an episode about the development of diplomacy, or how diplomacy was carried out in the old days, and how these practices changed during the Renaissance. And so let me start by asking the question, what diplomacy is? Though that might seem like an utterly daft question. There's a famous diplomat and writer called Ernest Satow, who in 1917 has the definition as, well, some stuff, and then summarised as, the conduct of business between states by peaceful means. So note the state thing, which is a bit of a problem since in days medieval it wasn't entirely clear what a state was, certainly not a modern nation state. We'll talk a bit more about that later. And then there's the peace thing. For those in the trade, peace comes up a lot as a reason for the existence of diplomacy, while as normal mortals, I suspect, tend to assume that diplomacy is about getting your own way. I had a similar conversation with an army guy once, where I childishly said that the point of armies is to kill people, and he gave me a much more mature answer that he joined the army to keep the peace, before putting me in a headlock and disabling me with a rabbit punch to the kidney and stringing me up by the ankles. Not really, obviously. But I have the same attitude to his mature answer as I do to that charter for diplomacy, really, kind of accepting and seeing the point, but kind of a little bit sceptical as well. Another definition from a diplomat called Harold Nicholson was, quote, the process and machinery by which negotiation is carried out. This feels like a very limited definition. Our Eustace Chapuis would have expected to do much more than this, notably information gathering and sharing, advising his masters on policy, advising his Spanish charges, such as Catherine. So the definition I liked described diplomacy as covering three very broad things. Representation. The need for kingdoms, monarchs, nations to be represented to others. Secondly, information gathering to inform policy and action. And third, cultural exchange. The need to understand and be understood and develop sympathy. Okay, so that's what it is. Though the way political leaders achieved those ends were very, very different through the ages. They would all emphasise different elements in that mix. And why don't I also note four very basic differences about how the world worked in days dark and medieval that have an impact on the diplomatic practice we'd recognise today. The first is the old chestnut of dynastic versus nation-state, which I referred to a minute ago. War and international relationships was the business of kings, the business of rulers, social equals talking to each other in the days medieval. Indeed, the subject matter that's most commonly being discussed, of course, we might consider to have a very strong personal and social element, marriage. The fact that the decisions the king or head of state would make in marriage or trade or war, the fact that that would tie everyone in the kingdom to it, was a bit irrelevant to the process. That was just the way it was. That was just a consequence. So that's point one. In medieval dynastic Europe, this is about the personal ambitions of rulers, and diplomacy is the discussion and agreement between those rulers. It's not the business of the ruled, unless rulers choose to involve them in some way. Second reason, then, why things aren't different then to the modern day. This is that if all these opinionated and self-important monarchy-type people do think they belong to anything, it is to Christendom. Christendom is the unifying theme of the medieval world, a kind of supranational organisation, just like the EU, except one that's really popular. This means a few things. It means that the papal curia, the papal court, has enormous influence in the way diplomacy develops, because it is a door to which all nations beat regularly, and also where they meet together, each other. It's a kind of permanent residence in embryo. As a concept, the identity of a shared Christendom deeply affects diplomats' own attitudes to what they do. They believe they have a role to embed the principles of Christianity into what they do, to work for a greater good and for peace. Now, this is often, even usually, sadly dissonant to what their bosses actually ask them to do, but nonetheless it is embedded in their attitudes, or at least what they write about their role. And finally, it also means that there is a universal church network, a network of churchmen with shared values and broad objectives, a shared community. Until the Reformation, that means there's this supranational ecclesiastical network parallel to the secular network, which was frequently helpful in them getting different kingdoms to talk to each other. Point three is about who might communicate with whom. And maybe it's a kind of 1A, I suppose. So we're again used to thinking in terms of nation-states, where there's usually no question that it's the legally constituted government that will be doing the communication. Well, in medieval Europe, you had your top-tier powerful people, emperors, kings, and so on, but you also had another tier, where they might not be a king or a ruler, but they are super worshipful, as they would have put it in the 14th century. So, for example, John of Gaunt, son of Edward III, sent formally accredited ambassadors who were received at royal courts just like any other ambassador from a king. Towns might do the same from within a kingdom. Towns sent embassies, and their kings received them without question. No one questioned the right of the Dukes of Milan or Brabant to send international embassies even though they were not kings. The modern smorgasbord of countries of all shapes, sizes and types of government is complicated enough, but it was even more so back in days medieval. Point four is that there is no commonly accepted legal framework which you might describe as international law. The closest you get to a shared law is Roman law, based on the Justinian Code from the 6th century, in the sense that it underpins many European legal systems. But of course there are many regional variations in practice, while in England it is common or customary law that does all the roost ruling. And anyway, nations had never got together to agree an internationally agreed part of it to govern how they work together. So, for example, let me take you to The Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, film version. I am sure you were horrified and scandalised, just like me, when Viggo, aka Aragorn, viciously cut off the head of Sauron's herald outside the Black Gates, unpleasant though the herald was. After all, he might have looked repulsive, though no doubt he had a mother who loved him, but more importantly, surely killing a diplomat is a fundamental breach of the rules. A breach of international law. But in medieval days, the same imminent danger very much existed as for poor old Sauron's herald. While there is a custom and practice about not shooting the messenger, there's no formal international law to protect them, and sometimes they got hurt or killed. So diplomacy was the business of rulers, the king's personal concern, which was in a sense true of every aspect of government, though from early times kings had at least had some functionaries around them to help in other areas of government. Now these were usually churchmen because of their literacy skills. In England, the starting point seems to have been the employment of a writing office, a chancery as it was called, led by a chancellor to send out the king's communications. As time went by, in England as elsewhere in Europe, governmental departments developed and grew, became more sophisticated. Small by modern day standards, but bureaucracies nonetheless. And they governed areas such as finance and law in particular. Much decision making might be devolved to the king's advisers through his king's council. But in the management of foreign relationships and policy, this was not the case. There was no foreign office. This was the king's personal affair. Now, the king might take advice, of course, as with anything, but kings took personal interest and drove decision-making personally. As late as the 15th century, Henry V ran much of the diplomatic process, for example. It is why in 17th century England, there is such an outrage from Charles I when Parliament claims to have jurisdiction over foreign policy as well as everything else. No, 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 and I say again, no, this is too far. This is the king's gig, and no one else's. I am the state is me. A process which ended in the cancellation of Christmas. It also meant that personalities and personal relationships are particularly critical in foreign policy. Marriage, of course, was famously an integral part of these relationships. Marriage was there to create and cement alliances, and are uniquely dynastic things. The very idea of them is, of course, family-oriented. The since the King of Spain's daughter is in your household, is your daughter. Both nations will, of course, continue to work together because you're family. So family relationships could change policy. If Henry VIII had stayed married to Catherine of Aragon, English policy would have been very different. If Queen Mary had lived married to Catholic Philip of Spain, the course of English foreign policy would have been very different. Personal relationships were also important in a different way. Rulers tried hard to meet face-to-face, and throughout English medieval history there's a stream of face-to-face meetings, summit meetings if you like, between the great men. Byzantine Emperor Manuel travelled Europe, including meeting Henry IV. Aethelwulf travelled all the way to Rome and made sure he visited the King of France on the way back. Travel was slow, the countryside and journey often violent and unsafe. These are enormous and risky investments, but kings felt them worthwhile. They were glittering, costly affairs. Richard II at Arras meeting the French king. The famous Field of the Cloth of Gold meeting between Henry VIII and Francis I of France. The idea was that personal discussion could resolve differences much more easily than a stream of messages or embassies. That these men, these rulers, could make decisions there and then, albeit on the back of lots of pre-work in the background by scurrying diplomats. In the end, it would be the decision of these individuals anyway. But of course, there was a limit to how often kings could meet. Security, time, distances, all counted against it. Henry V was quite exceptional in meeting the Holy Roman Emperor, the Duke of Burgundy, and the French Dauphin. They just didn't have the time and therefore had to use messengers. But decision-making was slower when you used messengers, because travel was slow, of course, as you might expect. And not just that, it varied a lot. It was inconsistent, depending on violence, winds, weather, all that sort of thing. Just how slow was it? So, if you were travelling as an official embassy, you would need to have a big entourage. Otherwise, you would besmirch the glory and reputation of the ruler you represented. You had to look grand. So in this case, 14 to 15 miles a day was the norm. That's what we see from King John's travels, for example, and the Countess of Leicester in the 13th century. It didn't really matter if you were in a hurry. If you had to take all those people and carts and stuff, that was your lot. So Paris to London can take you 12 days from Calais, never mind the pain of waiting for the wind to change at Dover. In extremis, with a slimmer entourage if you could get away with it, faster was possible. A merchant would reckon on 25 to 30 miles a day. But of course, on a diplomatic mission, you could use couriers, and possibly even a chain of couriers. And these guys might get up to 60 miles a day under their belt, so that would be 3 days from Paris to Calais. If you were lucky, 3 more days to London. As you will learn or know, it is in northern Italy that so many refinements are made in the early modern era to the practice of diplomacy. And Italian historians have studied the letters in and the letters out. So, 17,000 letters sent between Florence and Genoa and Florence and Venice took between 5 and 7 days. That's an average of 26 miles a day. A figure that's probably messed up by the time it takes to get across the lagoon to Venice. London to Naples took anything between 27 and 54 days, which is between 17 and 46 miles a day. Venice to Constantinople should take 20 days. To reinforce the point, it's not just that communication is slow, it's also uncertain. Your courier might be robbed, or you might get lost. You might sink, get blown seriously off course. So look at those times from London to Naples, anywhere between 27 and 54 days. That's quite a broad range. Now, to compensate, the messages were often sent by alternative methods, so land and sea. Big fat smelly bloke and sleek young greyhound. But there was still a very real risk the message would not get through at all, and it would take you ages before you knew. The path was strewn with banditry and robbers. One very real consideration was that if you sent a grand personage, they would be much more likely to attract attention than a humble messenger, but would be less likely to be attacked or be able to defend themselves, whereas a humble messenger might be more secret, but they were very vulnerable. So the point is embarrassingly obvious. Purely using messengers made decision-making frighteningly slow. Empowering folk to make decisions on your behalf, now that really oiled the wheels, if you could bear to do it as a ruler. Because let's say I'm King of England, which for England would be great, by the way, and I'm negotiating with the Pope. In a conversation, it's going to take me at best 2 months to get a message and get their reply. When using a messenger, you had some challenges and decisions to make. So messengers travel between kings and leaders, personal messages. One of the first problems then was establishing credibility. How did you know that this total stranger that had tipped up at your court was who he said he was? And so credentials were of course critical, and these tend to come in two forms right from the start. The first, obviously enough, was a letter, and what do you know? The word diplomacy itself comes from diploma, which derives from the Greek for a folded letter. But more was often required, a symbol or an object to confirm that the letter was indeed authentic. It might be a ring, later a seal, became the obvious identifier. In the Chanson de Roland, written in the 11th century, Charlemagne's envoy covers a glove and a wand, which could well be there to identify his role and whom he represents. You also had to decide how this communication would happen, and you had some choices. You could write everything down and essentially have the messenger be a postman delivering the letter, or the messenger could relay the message. Both of these had some risks. If you wrote everything down, it could be intercepted. We know of plenty of examples, especially when we get to the Renaissance, where letters are carefully opened and then resealed. And of course, the rules of immunity would not be defined for some time. Plus, of course, writing it all down was inflexible, with less room for manoeuvre, and it was difficult to control or include nuance. Now, if it was in any way secret or sensitive, writing it down was a big risk. Royal agents did what they could. We know of envoys with papers sewn into their clothing, for example, in good old boyzone style. So what was more common was the normal practice that applied to letter writing throughout society, not just for diplomacy. This was the combination of a formal letter and a personal message by mouth. We see this very clearly with the Pastern letters. A note that says, "Hi, we think you're great, this is Alan, he's got more things to tell you." So in the diplomatic idiom, you sent a letter to establish credentials, and you sent some anodyne diplomatic tripe, of which we're all familiar, and then you instructed your envoy as to what they would then really say, the meat of the message. So that's good, less risky. But the problem you then had is that for a long journey, the messenger was likely to forget the precise nature of the communication. Plus, you might need to instruct the envoy on different approaches he might take or different ways in which he might react. The frustrations of allowing envoys to speak their communications are palpable through the age. There's an instruction that survives from Edward I, for example, that reads, "Read this schedule frequently and understand it well, so that no word in it gets changed." I can imagine it. You craft your subtly nuanced communication, and your envoy ends up charging the cannon down the wrong valley, for crying out loud. So sometimes, or even often, these instructions were themselves written down. And in fact, by the later Middle Ages, double instructions were completely standard. One set to hand out, another for the agent's eyes only. Now, I can see you rolling your eyes on your bike or train or indeed in bed. You are clearly sharp, intelligent people, given you've signed up to this podcast. You'd have to be. So, I know you've already spotted the obvious problem. We are back again to the risk that these instructions would get opened by the other side. In the 1520s, for example, Cardinal Wolsey, Henry VIII's chief minister, and Gattinara, Emperor Charles V's equivalent, would quite often openly stop diplomatic couriers and open all their dispatches. One solution was to put dispatches in code. And by the last quarter of the 15th century, this is routine. It was also pretty hopeless. Simple substitution codes tended to be used, or codes were simply used for far too long and therefore they were broken, or everything got too complicated and no one could understand it. There are some lovely records from the Spanish ambassador to London, Pedro de Ayala, who just couldn't get the hang of it, couldn't get his head round the whole thing. His reports kept being annotated by grumpy and frustrated officials back home in Spain. "Impossible," said one. "Nonsense," said another. All of it came to a head when Ayala received a letter back from Madrid. It thanked him for sending his report so carefully encoded. It also thanked him for sending the code book back with the same package. I'm guessing there was a little sarcasm involved. As diplomats became more experienced in the 16th century, they tended to move towards avoiding writing anything that would offend as much as possible. And then, where they absolutely had to, taking elaborate security precautions for those few occasions when it was absolutely necessary to have secret written instruction. In short, they behaved on the assumption that their letters would be opened. There was no sanctity of the diplomatic bag. Where the letter was meant to be public, by the way, it had to be very carefully crafted in terms of precedence. And when they do appear, it's worth noting that an inordinate amount of time of the resident ambassador's time is spent on that same issue of precedence. It is absolutely critical in medieval and early modern society. You had to know your role and your place. We have ample examples from legal cases of fights because the man of lower status didn't move out of the way on the street or tip his cap in the right way to his betters. Honour was critical. So in letter terms, if a king was talking to his subjects, the king's own name came first. But in letters to foreign powers, it comes second, unless you're absolutely certain that the person you are addressing is of lower social status. In physical meetings, there were endless arguments about the order in which people should enter or where they should sit. And I imagine that goes on every bit as much now as it did then. One of the reasons I don't work in the diplomatic service. Right along with failing the exam and them not wanting me, of course. There is an assumption here, which is that the envoy in question is nothing more than a messenger, which was very often the case. But you might very well want to appoint someone who has the right to negotiate, to represent you, rather than just carry a message. And folks like this get described as proctors or procurators. This would have a big impact on your next decision. Who should you send? Now, we're used to a system where diplomats are officers of the state, and therefore their personal status is irrelevant. They can, in a sense, be a total numpty, because their message and the priority accorded them will be judged on the basis of their country's reputation rather than their own. Now, I am not suggesting for a moment that we are in the habit of selecting numpties for our diplomatic service. Far from it, I am sure. But you take the point. The point is that it's the office, the job, that counts. However, before the Renaissance, this was not the case. If you were sending an envoy to speak on your behalf, the status of the envoy could make a difference. Now, by and large, the rule applied that if you're sending a simple messenger, a courier, then the status of the messenger was not a great issue. But even that's not always true. For example, Ralph d'Escure was the Archbishop of Canterbury in 1119, and he'd been accused by Pope Calixtus II of arrogance in not appointing Thurston to be Archbishop of York, i.e. the Pope's candidate. Ralph had to grovel, but he was too ill to go to Rome himself, and so he had to send a servant. But in this case, the status of the servant clearly was an issue, because Ralph was clearly worried, and in his letter he grovelled with apology that his courier was so lowly. It could also vary according to the country. Courts had different attitudes. Specifically, anything other than high-status envoys carried the risk of offence when communicating with the Byzantine emperor. In early medieval Europe, there was a perfect answer for an envoy, the clergy. As far as the Anglo-Saxons were concerned, this was absolutely self-evident. Abbots and bishops were high status. They were men of wealth and power. They were leaders of the Christian church and indeed of the country, and it made them ideal angels of peace. Plus, they were literate. They could speak the international language of Latin, and not to be ignored, they were part of a broadly non-political network, or at least a Christian network with a wider range of interests and loyalties, the international church. Local churchmen who could make friendly introductions and gain useful information for them. And so, for example, when Ethelred the Unready made peace with Richard I of Normandy, he sent Bishop Aselsiege of Sherborne. But there are many, many examples. The point is, though, that if serious negotiation is required, who you sent was critical. Not only in the obvious sense that you needed somebody competent so they didn't land you with a whole load of horrid commitments, although we'll come to that later. No, they had to be credible to the other side, and credible in their own person. Having the right credentials from the king was not enough. So, for example, the Holy Roman Emperor Henry IV, during the investiture crisis with Pope Gregory VII in 1079. Henry sent a letter carefully explaining that his envoys are of such status that the Pope can believe their authority and can be confident that Henry would ratify any treaty they negotiated with him. It's this that makes Warwick the Kingmaker so livid with Edward IV over the negotiation of Edward IV's marriage. When Warwick goes to negotiate with the French court, he is in principle the perfect procurator, of the highest possible status and confidence with the king. Louis would have been utterly confident that he was talking to the right person. Warwick's personal wealth and position would convince anyone that the King of England was a great man and that the King of England would listen to this great man when he came home. So when Edward IV pulled the rug and calmly announced that he had gone and married someone else, it was an insult to Warwick, but it was also an insult to Louis. And it was a betrayal of the principles of diplomatic practice which could undermine any future communications. Negotiations were, then as now, complex and expensive affairs. And in general, I think we would recognise how these went today. The disastrous conference at Arras, for example, in 1439, where Cardinal Beaufort was sent to negotiate with the French, failed to reach agreement, saw Burgundy and France make peace and cut England out. At that kind of event, the status of the negotiator was indeed critical, and Beaufort could hardly have been higher status. Beaufort carried with him letters of credence, but also his personal secret instructions, laying out how far he could go, how far he could negotiate. And with him went an army of experts. It's been estimated that the conference at Arras was a negotiation that involved 5,000 people. And Beaufort took with him clergy, civil, canon lawyers, royal secretaries, household knights, and more lowly servants as runners. Not really sure this is the brief of this episode, but hey, I thought it would be nice to visualise one of these negotiations. At Arras, everyone sat in the big hall at the local abbey. In the middle sat the mediator, the papal envoys in this case, seated on a throne, while the various parties were sat on benches. Each party had their own room to retire to. Sessions began at 7 a.m, which is early, is it not? I'm not prepared to agree to anything until after 9. Anyway, they'd end for a nice long lunch and a snooze and start again at 3 p.m. Proceedings began with the reading out of the procurator's credentials, which sounds super dull, and then each side did a proclamation of how meet and right and just were their claims, which were then, of course, routinely ridiculed privately by the other side. So why bother might well be your question, and indeed mine. Then it was offers time. Each side made offers alternately. The mediator would review and decide if actually this new offer did narrow the gap and make any difference. And if so, they would then take it over to the other side, and then so on, like a game of tennis. At some point, they either admitted failure, or they created articles of agreement. This approach did, of course, reduce the risk for a ruler, although he solemnly swore that he'd abide by the decisions of his negotiators. In the end, the treaty had to be ratified by him. So there was always a get-out clause of last resort. It was a get-out clause used by the French after Bretigny in the Hundred Years' War, for example. Okey-dokey, so this is all the stuff going on in the Middle Ages. What is it that changes? And how is diplomacy carried out in the 16th century? Why do things change? You will notice that in all the discussion so far, there has been no mention of the permanent ambassador, such a basic and fundamental feature of modern diplomacy. The arrival of the resident representative, as it were, is a key feature of the very late 15th century and the early 16th. How did it come about? Well, there's more than one source for the idea. And one of these is the papacy. Because if there is a centre of diplomatic activity throughout the Middle Ages, it is the papal curia, and each nation's interactions with the Pope. Quite simply because from very early medieval days, most kings had much more regular communication with the Pope than they had with any other foreign leader. Because of all those conversations about church appointments, benefices, marriage dispensations, and all that sort of thing. This meant that the papal curia was the place where monarchs tended to keep a permanent representative, or at least semi-permanent representative. It meant that this was the closest place Europe got to a permanent location where the discussions and negotiations could take place, between kingdoms, not just between kingdoms and the Pope. English kings tended to maintain semi-permanent proctors in the papal court from very early on, able to execute instructions, and unsurprisingly, these people tended to be clergymen. But by 1413, Henry V had realised that what happened at the papal court was not just important because of conducting business with the Pope. It was the only place where representatives of all kingdoms routinely gathered. Henry V needed, in his own words, promoters of the nation at the papal curia. The importance of the papal curia worked both ways, because in reverse, the Pope had more experience of semi-permanent representatives, because they regularly used papal legates, who would be in country for extended periods and actually began to look like permanent representatives. Another possible source was the growing merchants' network. As international trade grew, the bigger and more international houses needed representatives in their main commercial centres. So the Italian banking houses would have a permanent representative in London, for example, while they went through the process of ruining themselves by doing business with Edward III. In some cases, before resident diplomats arrived on the scene, heads of state would tap into this network, and they'd use it for their own needs. So Venice, for example, kept permanent representatives abroad, notably a position called the bailo at Constantinople. The bailli was a commercial representative of the merchant community, but he also reported on developments at court in Constantinople, and thus helped shape policy. In addition, the bailli might be entrusted with the negotiations, where it was decided that a special embassy wasn't needed, and this really speeded things up. But probably the single biggest factor was the development of a regular professional diplomatic relationship between the city-states of northern Italy. In the 15th and 16th centuries, a peculiar set of circumstances arose in Italy. Here you had a closely packed series of competing nation-states. Here in the 15th century was the constant threat of warfare and a search for a balance of power which could deliver peace, which, at the Treaty of Lodi in 1454, was finally achieved. For the following 40 years, until Charles VIII invaded the peninsula, there was a constant flow of diplomatic activity to maintain this balance. Even after the failure of this fragile peace, success for northern Italian city-states depended on careful and agile international policies, well-informed, based on the latest information. Individually, city-states were no match for the resources of those much greater entities such as France and the Empire. They relied on their diplomacy to shape and control events, sometimes with enormous success, sometimes with spectacular failure. And here also was the cradle of early humanism, with its emphasis on rhetoric and the art of persuasion. Before the end of the 15th century then, resident ambassadors were common throughout Italy. It was probably mighty Milan which consistently followed the practice first. Filippo Maria Visconti sent embassies so consistently to the court of the emperor that it was almost indistinguishable from the real thing, until it did, in fact, become the real thing. By the mid-15th century, all the major Italian players, Milan, Venice, Naples, Florence, had permanent ambassadors with each other. By 1480, all the major Italian states used them with the major courts of Europe too, the papacy, the empire, France, and often England. And then from around 1500, the practice spread. So in England, for example, Henry VII would have become quickly used to having a permanent Spanish ambassador after the arrival of Don Rodrigo González de Puebla in 1497. From there, it continued to grow. England established its first permanent ambassador in 1509, as did France. By the 1540s, the network of permanent embassies was embedded throughout Europe. By 1547, France had 10 such posts, and these ambassadors didn't just go to the friendly states, they went everywhere significant, including those you'd just been fighting with. The new embassies might be composed of several people, more than one ambassador for starters, but support staff as it were, secretaries in particular. Notably, there is a major change in who these people are, what their social background is. This changes because the personal status of the ambassador no longer reflected the status of the embassy. Within reason, of course, don't get me wrong, Europe hasn't suddenly become a series of socialist, anarcho-syndicalist republics. No one called Dennis need apply. Everyone still agrees that to be successful, you need all the things that generally come with education and a degree of wealth. Nonetheless, this is a major shift. It speaks of taking one step away from that very personal nature of diplomacy towards a professional service. A degree of wealth was needed because of a very typical feature of the early modern state: high expectations, low standard of efficiency and ability to pay. So on the one hand, ambassadors had rules about the entourage that they were expected to take, the level of grandeur they could generate. Italian governments stipulated 10 or 12 men with 6 or 8 horses. It would dishonour the state if the ambassador couldn't put on the right show. On the other hand, the state might have been offering to pay for all this in theory, but you had to be reasonably flush to embark on the job because early modern governments are notoriously bad payers. So to be an ambassador, you'd need to be rich enough to manage a load of expenses from your personal account while expense payments came through. Permanent ambassadors and ambassadorial staff were recruited from the more middle sort now. It was still generally agreed that the perfect diplomat was, quote, rich, well-born and handsome. And the magnate like Cardinal Beaufort or Warwick the Kingmaker still very definitely did have a role, but it was reserved for those big, special embassies, where some treaty or high-profile special arrangement needed to be negotiated. In addition, the summit meeting, ruler to ruler, declined dramatically after 1530. Now such a meeting, relatively rare anyway, is very exceptional. The other type of diplomat that disappeared was the churchman. Partly, that's about the general professionalisation of the service, but it's also about the religion, of course. These developments were taking place as the Reformation unfolded and religion became deeply divisive rather than bringing people together. And no formal separation of role and person could deal with that. By the 1560s, everyone agreed that churchmen, once the perfect ambassador, were now completely unsuitable. Disappointingly, given the reputation of folks like Cesare Borgia, there appears to have been no budget for bribing and spying, or should we say for information gathering. Or there didn't seem to be in the Italian budgets, and the same is true for Spain. Fortunately, elsewhere in Austria, Netherlands, France and England, pensions and presents to noblemen and councillors were very much part of the budget. But whether you had a budget for bribery or not, the key skill of the ambassador was to listen. That was the way to gather information. And I feel a digression coming on as I speak. So the all-time international master of diplomacy is often said to be the French master called Talleyrand of the 18th and 19th centuries. It's hard to have to wait to catch up to a period of history sometimes, and Talleyrand's is a good example of a story that really needs to be told properly. A man who lived through the French Revolution and deep into the new Europe on the other side, when Europe was dominated by the great powers and the concept of the balance of power. A full story will have to wait, though. Meanwhile, he is also a fertile ground for quotes. Seriously, look him up. And he has a few bon mots to offer on the practice of diplomacy. Speech, said Talleyrand rather cynically, was given to man to disguise his thoughts. Diplomacy was the art of saying nice doggy until he can find a bigger stick. And his view of a good diplomat was defined by the phrase, a diplomat who says yes means maybe, a diplomat who says maybe means no, and a diplomat who says no is no diplomat. Delightful. Ever so slightly cynical, but delightful. Talleyrand was a man so devious and convoluted that when he died, one of his arch rivals, the Austrian Chancellor Metternich, no slouch at the art himself, was supposed to have said on his death, I wonder what he meant by that. This is diplomacy as we imagine it. Anyway, the reason I got onto Talleyrand was because of the point about listening. Talleyrand also noted that diplomacy would have been impossible if people learned to hold their tongues, and at the courts of Henry VII and Henry VIII, the imperial ambassadors are there, part of the game, part of the court, watching, listening, commenting, and writing it all down and sending it home. Because the new Italian permanent ambassadors sent back regular relazioni, reports, the like of which have now prompted this podcast. And with all these permanent ambassadors hanging around and all these reports, an organisation was now needed. Organisations were needed to support the day-to-day work of the diplomats, process the reports, present them to the government, whether the Duke in Milan or the relevant committee in Florence, manage the information flow and instructions back and forth, process the finances. As the role becomes more professionalised, there's also a flush of studies and advice documents that describe and regularise the work of diplomats. Meanwhile, the ambassador's perception of their role shifted as well. Now that the ambassador's personal status doesn't reflect on the role, it also becomes accepted by diplomats that they do not put their personal honour at stake in the role. That they will not feel personally shamed if their ruler called upon them to lie, or if they ended up lying as a consequence of a shift in policy. If Warwick had gone to France to negotiate Edward IV's marriage 50 years later, so around 1500, he might have taken Edward's unreliability in a much more relaxed way, though I rather doubt it, given Warwick. If I'd been a horse hanging around, I'd have still made myself scarce. There is a famous 17th century English diplomat called Henry Wotton, who famously reflected that, quote, an ambassador is an honest gentleman sent abroad to lie for the good of his country. That's not to say ambassadors found this shift easy. For example, one French Calvinist diplomat, Hotman, wrote, it goes against the grain for a man of honour to lie and cheat, like a low-born and low-hearted rogue. Sadly for Hotman, though, essentially, the ambassador was now an extension of the state. He had no private views in his job. Though there were limits, it was generally agreed that the ambassador was not bound to obedience if the prince's order contravened moral law. The law of God still reigned supreme. The question of diplomatic immunity remained, however, largely unresolved, though there are developments in the right direction. As I've mentioned, there was no framework of international law that could carry the concept of diplomatic immunity. True enough, the Renaissance and humanists rekindled an interest in Roman law, and rulers throughout Europe, even England, sought to reap the benefits of a system that focused on the primacy of the secular ruler. But immunity was still a function of custom and practice. If we reach back again to the 11th century, that wand that Charlemagne's herald carried was very probably the attempt to illustrate his office and protect him. But heralds and messengers was absolutely dependent on the personal behaviour of kings and the relationships between their rulers. By the 16th century, there were definite movements, but it's still very much a hybrid system. On the one hand, diplomatic immunity was agreed as being a good idea and the safety of diplomats assured. On the one hand, they were still liable for personal prosecution if they broke the laws of the land locally, though only by the prince's highest courts it was agreed. But essentially, while it's therefore better defined, While diplomats could be prosecuted at all, that means there's no real immunity. However, with the Reformation, one of the critical questions becomes whether the embassy should be allowed its own chapel, practicing the ambassador's own religion, and rulers realise they have to accommodate this. So to get round the problem, the legal fiction arose that the ambassador's residence itself is a piece of his own country rather than the host country, therefore to reduce any potential conflicts over religion. And it seems sensible to apply this to law also. So better definition will need to wait for the 17th and 18th centuries, but without doubt it strengthened the position of the resident ambassador. So, in summary, how much were changes driven by the politics of northern Italy? Did the late 15th and early 16th centuries see a step change in the professionalism and structure of diplomatic practice? Because as you might expect, there is a counter-argument, and as normal for historians, it all leads towards continuity rather than big paradigm shifts, of which history has far fewer than you might hope, and of which historians are not overly fond. A couple of points. One is that these changes in diplomatic practice need to be seen in the light of what historians have called the new monarchies. France, Spain, the Empire, even England began to concentrate on the internal organisation and focus of their states, once the internal conflicts of the 15th century had resided somewhat, to organise the resources of their states more effectively for external competition. Part of all of this was the growth of bureaucracy to marshal and develop those resources better and indeed to gather taxes. The diplomatic service, the employment of professional state officers, the organisation of chancelleries to support them and use their information effectively could be seen as part of that general trend, as much as being driven by the needs of northern Italy. Maybe it would have happened anyway. It's also been noted that one of the big drivers for investment in diplomatic structures was in the growing complexity of Europe. One historian I read used the phrase multipolarity, which is a deeply unattractive phrase, but yes, okay, there were an awful lot of states in a small space, especially when you take the northern Italian cities into account. However, the counter-argument is that this is really nothing new. Europe had always been a complicated place. We should also point out that it's easy to underestimate the professionalism of medieval diplomacy. Henry IV and Henry V, fully a century before these changes are supposed to have taken place, have established a regular process and department to manage international information in England. While there may have been no permanent residences, the business of vast special embassies and complex treaty negotiations were equally very well established, as we saw at the Treaty of Arras. The household men, lawyers, churchmen employed on these missions were often very experienced, very often selected specifically because they had specialist skills and knowledge. On balance, it seems to me that something fundamental did indeed change during the early modern period. Though as ever, maybe it's less of a revolution and more of an evolution. But the drivers did appear to be changing. The idea of an all-embracing Christendom was crumbling. The international ambitions of major players were very much focused on Italy for much of the first half of the 16th century, where the complexities of the northern states of Italy impacted everything. I am by nature very much a gradualist, very much not a lover of conspiracy theories. So I naturally gravitate towards the argument that things change and evolve rather than shifting dramatically. But I have to say, whatever the reason, there does seem to have been this very significant change in how diplomacy got carried on around the late 15th and early 16th centuries. Particularly the permanent ambassador, the start of the development of the rule of international law, some level of immunity, the idea of an embassy being foreign soil, not seismic change maybe. But at the start of the period, diplomacy looks very different to the modern day. By the end of it, the similarities are more striking. Well, that brings me to the end of my very first Shedcast, hurrah, which was a joy to research and write. I hope the earth moved for you too. Thank you everyone, very much indeed. The very fact that you're listening to this means that you have chosen to support the History of England, otherwise known as me. So double thank you, and have a wonderful week full of joy and laughter.